Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say a menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac Killer. Betsy Gebhardt has details.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
You're back in the House of Mystery. I'm your host today, Al Warren, and Kev Thompson is here as well.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, so before we get into the guest in the show, Chicago, things are looking up. 102 shootings over the July 4th weekend and only 15 fatalities.
Means that their skills are dropping. You know, it is a perishable skill.
they're missing more. I just can't say enough good. I don't know, man. It's crazy. And our guest is actually in the Chicago location.
Uh-oh. with only 15 fatalities, he doesn't have much to worry about.
No, but good place to make movies. So filmmaker John Borowski, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on. Yeah, it's, Chicago held the title of murder capital of the U.S. a while back. I don't know if it still is, but it's perpetual, you know. I film these huge meetings with, city officials and other people, and, some people are trying, but, it's just that.
But what's going on? Like, why is it so high? And it's been this way for years now. Huge shootings.
Yeah, and
so what is it about Chicago? Like, what is it specifically? Is there something going on there that we need to know about?
Well, I mean, it's basically risen, I think, within the last, I don't know, maybe 5 to 20 years, because even when I was a teenager and in my early 20s, I didn't hear about all these shootings in Chicago. So, there is a lot of gang activity, and, I think in the end, these guys aren't good shots. They wind up shooting elderly and children. That's the problem. And these poor people are caught in the crossfire, and they're the victims. In the end, that's what it is. And unfortunately, it's, relegated to the south side of Chicago, it's the poorer communities, and that's where it's all going on. And you got to get to these kids. My feeling is you got to get to these kids when they're younger, and get them into after school programs so they're not going out to get involved with gangs and drugs. It's such a huge issue, and it doesn't seem like anybody's really trying to do anything about it, And to me personally, I feel, you have a lot of these celebrities, you have some celebrities that were from Chicago, obviously, Oprah and some other people, but you have all these, African-American celebrities, around the world, too, and they're ignoring it, and it seems like, to me, I mean, I remember when there were the black and white police issues happening in L.A., and I remember when Snoop Dogg, took a whole mass of people and walked politely to the sheriff's office and had a meeting with them. I never heard of that done by a celebrity. These are the people with money and power. The rest of us, we're trying to struggle and we're surviving, and we don't know what we could do about it personally. I'd love to do a documentary on it, but I'm sure people have, and I'd never find an answer,
Yeah. Well, and more people are getting shot there and killed than Afghanistan and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's like a war zone. it's bad, you know. And again, you know, I live on the north side, you know, you have that occurring here too, you know, but it's really, you know, and what's happened also that I've noticed personally, you know, there was always this north side, south side, you know, and even our sports team, you know, the Cubs are north side, the Sox are white, south side. So there's always this, you know, north versus south side, but over the last, I think, especially 20, 30 years, the divide between north and south and rich and poor and you know, white and African American has even grown more of a divide. And to me, that's a shame.
Yeah, it's terrible. And well, it's a good atmosphere, I guess, for you to be doing film in serial.
Well, you know what I always say when I do lectures at conventions and when I have a speaking engagement, Chicago's the home to serial killers, gangsters, and corrupt politicians. Really, when you think about it,
yeah.
It is. You know, I mean, how many governors have been put in prison the last two or three? The gangster lore here with Capone and, St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And then you've got all these serial killers from Chicago and in the Midwest as well. So I guess it is a good location for me to be in.
Yeah, good atmosphere. Now, there's a couple of things I've been wanting to talk to you about. I know that you have a new film out and called Bloodlines. That was really appealing to me, even though I don't think I like the idea. Well, you know, because this is the life of Vincent Castiglia, I guess.
Castiglia.
Thank you.
Castiglia.
Yeah, and he is now. So he's a guy that does tattoos with blood.
No. He paints in human blood, exclusively in human blood. He paints on canvas, but he tattoos, you know, with regular inks. Tattooing is kind of like, you know, his kind of day gig. You know, he takes his art skills and, you know, makes money by appearing at tattoo conventions and traveling and doing those things while he is creating his art, you know. And yeah, you know, some people are turned off by, you know, even the mention of him painting in blood. You know, I mean, yeah, tattooing in blood would definitely be very strange. That would
Well, when I saw the scene of him tattooing, and I thought, oh, is he tattooing in blood? But so he's doing painting with human blood. Whose blood is he using?
Well, what he does is, whenever it's his original artworks, he uses his own blood, and he has a nurse or a phlebotomist draw the blood because, you know, once you see the movie, you'll learn more about the reasons why he began painting in blood and how he does it exactly. So I don't want to get too much away, but he does have a nurse or a phlebotomist draw his blood. You know, when we began, talking about me producing a film on, you know, him and his art, you know, I had learned that he had painted people's portraits in their blood, like Margaret Cho, he had painted in her blood, so her blood was drawn, and then he painted her portrait in her blood, and he had done a whole white guitar in the blood of Gary Holt for the band Slayer. He's a guitarist for Slayer. So now he's doing more of these personalized pieces where he will draw the collector's blood and paint an image for them. And so when we first started talking about this film, I said, okay, look, you know, I want to make this film, but, you know, I want my portrait painted in my blood. So we agreed on that as well as part of the process. So the first time I visited Vincent in New York, I sat down and get a nurse that drew 13 vials of my blood, and he painted my portrait, and it's like 2 feet by 3 feet, a large painting, all of my blood, and these things could take him a month to do.
Wow. And, well,
yeah.
I guess they could always, you know, in the future, after you're dead, they can always take your painting and get your DNA and maybe do a clone.
Right, exactly. I know. I mean, you know, this painting of me and Vincent's paintings and the other people, you know, his collectors that the paintings are done in their blood, you know, it is. It's part of their DNA. It's a part of them. You know, it's part of their tissue, which is very interesting, you know. And some people are turned off when they hear about what he's doing, but then I explain it a little more. And, you know, when you see his final artworks, you would never know. They just look like sepia artworks, but, you know, they are beautiful. They're not just, you know, paint, blood dripped on a canvas. You know, he does different shades. And again, when you see the film, you learn how, but, you know, there's tones and shades, and he uses the white space of the canvas as negative space. So he kind of has to, and, you know, he can't correct it. There's no whiteout. He doesn't, you know, he only uses blood. So he has to have this total vision on this canvas before he starts. It's a very difficult process. And again, once you see the documentary, you'll learn why. But I was fascinated by it. I was a fan of his. And so I think it was 2013, 2014, we were both fans and friends on Facebook, and he had posted something asking people if he should do a reality show. And, you know, of course, the typical reaction from people were, oh, yeah, that's great, cool, yeah, that would be so good. Yeah. But, you know, I wrote a long comment, and I said, you know, I think it would actually do a disservice to you because, you know, I know what these reality shows are like. They want to cause conflict. They're scripted. They're not really reality shows. You know, and I said, in the end, you might wind up looking like a fool. You might get some publicity, but once the show is done, who's going to remember that show 20 years from now or 100 years from now? I told him that, you know, you deserve a documentary that focuses on your entire art and your life and what brought you to this point that will last hundreds of years, that people could watch this and say, wow, these are the beginnings of a phenomenal artist, you know, like a future Giger or a Dali or a Michelangelo. I mean, Margaret Cho compared him to Michelangelo. Again, when you see his works, plus the medium he works in, it's fascinating.
Wow. Wow. I guess next they'll be using brain matter and...
Who knows? Probably. Maybe they'll grind intestines down and, you know, pig guts and brains and who knows. But again, you know, it's definitely personal. And again, there's a reason for it. Like I said, I don't want to get too much of the film away. But, you know, he's big in with obviously the heavy metal crowd because he does, you know, he did the Slayer guitar and those people know him and he's done commissioned artworks. And his first major show was at the Giger Museum in Switzerland. So, you know, Giger took him kind of under his wing and, you know, we filmed at Giger's studio and at the museum, and Giger had passed away a year before I was out there, and I could have met him. You know, he was like an idol of mine, of course, because he did The Creature Alien and all these other artworks, and Poltergeist 2, the movie, and, you know, Species, you know, just a phenomenal, phenomenal artist. And you see these artworks that he did in airbrush. They're huge panels, you know, probably like 4 foot by 8 foot high, that you put like three of these panels together, and like a whole wall that you could get lost in this whole universe that then it's all mainly black and white. He did some color works too. But, you know, there's, you know, that's why this film is so fascinating. You know, it runs about 91 minutes. We do have a distributor now, so it's going to be out on November 13th. It'll be released streaming and DVD, and we're still working out all the exacts on that. And but just, you know, Margaret Cho's in the film. Greg Allman, who passed away last year, you know, of the Allman Brothers band, he owns a piece of Vincent's art. And he said when he heard it was created in blood, he had to have it. So he's in the film, and Slayer is in the film, and Lamb of God, and, you know, art critics, and we have, you know, Salvador Dali's interior designers in the film. So, you know, we have all these different people. It's not just gore or heavy metal. I mean, Tony Timpone from Fangoria, you know, is in it. So there's horror, there's art, there's life, there's death, you know, and what Vincent had gone through to kind of come to this point where he was peeing blood and all the, you know, awful things that have kind of happened in his life that you have to see the movie fun now.
So now, okay, so you, when are people going to be able to see it?
Well, yeah, November 13th. I mean, we are having some screenings now, like, you know, there's some festivals that I'm talking to and, you know, some screenings are occurring between now and November. But, the next screening is going to be August, I believe it's August 4th, 3rd or 4th, at Flashback, the horror convention here in Chicago. And they're going to screen it there. So it isn't released yet. November 13th is the official release date. So then that's the date it'll be on DVD and stream.
Now, are you trying to stream through anybody but Amazon?
No, you know, it's a strange situation now for indie filmmakers, and I don't know what happened this year, but this year, especially literally starting this beginning of July of this year, strange things have happened all over with the internet and streaming and regulations. Very weird. You know, again, I'm not privy to a lot of these things. I know there were there was this internet regulation thing that I don't know if it went through or whatever, but there was that. But for the last two or three years, Amazon was really the savior of indie filmmakers. You know, what they were doing was allowing indies to upload their work directly and not deal with a distributor and paying us directly. And, you know, as long as your film had closed captioning, you could do that. And it was great. I mean, for me, it was amazing. It allowed me to, you know, get paid what I deserve, but yet I could concentrate on my work without having to drive an Uber or, you know, work a day job. So it was awesome. And then I had deals from Netflix for like the last 7-8 years. Netflix picked up every movie I had. They, you know, distributed it and streaming. It was out there. And H.H. Holmes, they had picked that up for 7 years straight. You know, the other ones, they would come and go, you know, whenever they could license my other films for a year or two. But Holmes was on there for, but this year, beginning of this year, Netflix said, nope, we're not showing Holmes anymore.
Really?
No, we're not interested in
that. Yeah. That's where I saw it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, here's what I heard. For an order for Netflix to renew films, I think they had to hit at least 1 million or 100 million views or whatever. So Holmes was a big hit for them. And I'm sure it still would be. But, you know, they're having budgetary issues because their money is going to original content. They told me this directly. They refused to pick up my new movie. Even the Bloodlines, even though we had a relationship the last 8 years, losing income from that, losing income from all my other titles that they're not picking up. And then Amazon dropped a bombshell this March saying, starting July 1st, we're cutting all the royalties by more than half. They were offering 15 cents an hour before, which wasn't too bad. They cut it from 15 cents to 6 cents an hour.
How did they do that?
They could do it because they're Amazon. You know, they said, well, if you read our, you know, policies, you know, you'll see that, you know, we require a 2 to 3 month notice for, given when any changes are to be occurred. And that's what they do. You know, they cover themselves legally. So that's what it was. So in March, they told everybody, okay, by July, you're going to be cut. And that's what it is. So now, you know, of course, me and many other creators are scrambling, and, you know, it's not a good situation. You know, it's strange because us indies, I see it, we kind of almost built those platforms. Because, you know, when Netflix started, they had a lot of indie stuff, and Amazon Prime as well. They had a lot of really interesting indie stuff, and they're kind of like throwing us out now. Yeah. Especially Netflix. I was really surprised by that and the fact that, you know, they didn't pick up Bloodlines. They told me it was too small of a film. And I said, really? With Greg Allman and Margaret Cho and Slayer and all these Damien Echols, big names in this? This is too small of a film?
Yeah.
So they just want to work with the big boys. It doesn't matter. They don't, I'm still a little guy. I could get De Niro in my movie. They're still not going to pick it up, literally.
Yeah.
Well, That's how it is.
What about the others, like the smaller ones that are starting up, like Crackle and all those other ones? Is there hope there?
There might be. You know, I'm working. I have a new distributor now that I'm working with on Bloodlines, and I'm going to see, you know, what develops with this new distributor. You know, Hulu was interested in Bloodlines with a different distributor, but they weren't offering that much. It was kind of more of an insult. So I said, no, I put that on the back burner. Now I have a new distributor. But, you know, it depends on
you know, if number one, how much per hour viewed these other streaming, you know, platforms are paying, plus, you know, are people actually, you know, how many people are, you know, being drawn to those platforms as well, you know, because of course Amazon, you had the built-in, you know, crowd there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But Amazon shot themselves in the foot. You know, here's what I think happened. People ask, well, what happened? Why did they do that? Why did they cut them in half? Well, here's what I think happened. They started with a good idea, but, you know, they probably thought that by having people closed caption their work, that would deter people from uploading home movies and family and, you know, whatever, right? But that didn't. So I think their servers were inundated, which they have to pay for. So, you know, believe me, they would have been smarter if they had said, look, we're going to charge every India fee to have this service. I would have gladly paid $2,000 or more a year for what I was getting. I would have gladly paid that. But they, you know, so now it's kind of collapsed and, you know, they don't even give anybody a reason or that's actually what happened. But I believe that's what happened. I don't know. But,
yeah.
You know, it's a very strange time, you know, and
yeah. Well, you know, they're doing a lot of strange things. For example, if you order too many items and return too many items, they'll just cancel your membership.
See, that right. And, you know, it's
very no
strange.
Warning.
Yeah. Yeah. That, and that's not right, too. I just cancel it. I mean, you get a refund because you have to pay for the whole year. I don't know how all that goes, you know. It's it's really strange times. I think YouTube did the same thing. I was, you know, I never was paid to have my films on YouTube. Well, I was through distributors, but I had never done it directly because you had to have something like 20,000 followers or a huge amount of followers to start charging people to view your work on YouTube. But YouTube did that this year as well. You know, they cut rates for people, you know, that have their films on there, filmmakers, and I don't know what's going on this year or what caused it, but you know, I'm hoping in the next year or two there is a company like Amazon or someone else that'll come in and help us. But, you know, what's going to happen between now and then, I don't know. You know, I'm struggling. I have books out too, and, you know, I'm working on a couple other books, and Bloodlines is coming out in November. But, you know, it just all takes time and time and money. And in the past, I was able to self-fund my films with the money that, you know, of course I've received from, you know, streaming and sales and everything, but if there isn't money coming in from the film, it's kind of difficult or impossible for me to make a film, or it's just plain insanity, you know, to make a film knowing that the profit is going to be nowhere near what you're putting into it. So I don't know. I mean, I hope it gets better, but right now, you know, I don't foresee myself making any more films. And that's sad. I've been doing this for 20 years. But right now, I can't do anymore. I can't make any more movies.
Yeah. You'd be down to driving Uber again.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. You know, and even that, that'll pay the bills. Not, I can't make movies with that, you know. And
yeah.
So it's tough, you know. But that's always, and, you know, there are these ebbs and flows. Because, you know, when H.H. Holmes was first released on DVD, that was near the end of DVD, beginning of streaming, when streaming was starting to come in to play, you know, like 2004, whatever it was. And what I would make in the first 3 months of DVD sales, now it takes me at least to make 2 years on stream. That's how long it takes. So that gives you an idea. 3 months of DVD sales versus 2 years of streaming, both equal the same amount. So that even, you know, even being paid well by streaming is nowhere compared to DVD.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So and now with Best Buy, you know, not carrying CDs anymore, and you know, the DVDs are they going to disappear too? I mean, I don't know. I always say you can't give. How fun is it to give a gift card? You can't give an MP3 as a gift and autograph it. You know, you need something physical. You can't collect MP3s.
It's,
you know, collectors need DVDs. You know, and when I go to conventions, I autograph them. And you know, personalize them with people. So I don't. Who knows what's going to happen? But you know, this mindset of streaming is the end all, save all isn't. You know, Netflix and some of these other channels, they don't have a great selection. I type in classic horror films, and there's nothing classic there. There's nothing good there.
Yeah, Yeah, you know. They're kind of going for the mainstream, the big stuff now.
Yeah, and you know, so you know, now I released season two of my latest TV show,
Serial Killer Culture TV.
Oh man, you know, and so this is the first show or a visual piece that I put on Amazon since their changes. And, it, you know, I'm doing that, obviously, because I'm in with Amazon already, and it's kind of working. But, you know, obviously, I'm working with new distributors, so things may change. And so I am working with Amazon, even though I'm not happy with them. But, you know, even though they're paying half of what they had paid before, it's still income. So right now I have to keep going with that and look at other options. You know, because, again, this did happen, you know, with DVD. When the transfer from DVD to streaming, I was all distraught. But then, you know, Netflix came in, and Netflix was doing good, and Hulu would buy my work too sometimes. But now we're going through another change, you know. So 7-8 years later, it's another change. So hopefully this is just a hump to get over. But it was so interesting. The first season of Serial Killer Culture TV I released last year, beginning of 2017, on Amazon Prime. And I self-released on DVD. Well, this year, I think it was April or May that I had uploaded the masters to Amazon Prime for the season two of the show. I didn't hear from them for like a month or two, and I kept asking them what's going on, you know, why this process is taking so long, because, you know, they don't even give you a release date. It's like, oh, well, your movie or show could go live in 2 days or 2 months, and you don't know when.
Yeah.
And they don't even have the courtesy to tell you. Like, I found out from other people when my show was live. Amazon didn't even say, okay, now it's live. It's like, okay, I can't even do a release date. You know, I can't do a proper release when it was on Amazon. So then they finally got back to me, you know, before it was approved, the season two, and they said, well, you know, our new policies are you have to change the name and artwork of your show because we cannot have TV in the title. Oh. They don't give a reason.
Okay.
But then I'm thinking, But then I'm thinking, well, for a whole year, the first season has been branded Serial Killer Culture TV. I mean, you know, they would never tell Paramount Pictures to go back and change Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, you know, once you brand a title, this is branded. And so I had to change it. In order for season two to be up, I had to change the title. Of course, I wasn't going to change the graphics on the actual, you know, shows themselves. I would have just told them if that's the case and just put them on DVD or whatever. But, you know, I had to change it to Serial Killer Culture, the web series, which is, I mean, it's no big deal. But, you know, again, when you have something branded that's in the public eye for a year, now you have to change the first season, the name of the first season, and it's just, but to me, people say, no, it's not against indies. No, I think it is because I've heard these stories. I've heard Amazon coming down on indie filmmakers saying, you can't have gratuitous nudity, gore, blah, blah, blah. But yet they have movies like Irreversible that has a 13-minute rape scene.
Yeah.
You know, unflinching rape scene. It's okay for them because they're the big boys. It happens all the time. You know, YouTube did that to me recently. There was one of these companies that make these short videos, like 10, you know, weirdest blah, blah, blah. And they had 10 last words of executed credit.
Oh, yeah, like Watch Mojo or one of those.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And they just felt free to not even ask me, not contact me, just pull parts of my film on Carl Panzram and put it in there. Just do it. And I mean, they did put a little bit of credit at the beginning, but they never asked me. And it's like, okay, you know, I'm not a big company. I put my own money into these things, you know, my time and you know, blood, sweat, and tears. And for people to do that, it's kind of irritating because I know they're making millions off of it, and I know I'm not making anywhere near that on my movies. So, you know, and then it's this big thing, and I contact YouTube, and they say it's free, fair use. Well, like I said, they went into... That's because Watch Mojo is all about money. They're getting hand in hand, and everyone's getting a cut of this, you know, 10 million views or whatever. Somebody's making money off of it. But, you know, and then I had to fight with YouTube. I had to fight with the company. And then the company was going to sue me, even though it's my thing, and say, well, we know this is fair use. So it got to a point where it's like, okay, well, what do I do? You know, do I give up? Do I try and fight them? And it got to a point where, you know, I kind of agreed with a friend of mine. He said, well, you know, if it's less effort, just ask them if they could extend the credit showing that it's your movie over the entire piece, which they did in the end. But it's still like, no, I don't get anything more than that.
Yeah, I think that's the unfortunate thing about the access of the internet and streaming, right? It just, it opens it up, and it's hard to keep it in control.
Yeah, it's, but, you know, I mean, the season two is up now, and I'm going to be creating the DVD for it as well.
Yeah. So what, season two, tell the listeners a little bit what it's about, what they're going to get.
Yeah, season two, again, it's the same format as season one, where I call it intimate interviews with individuals that are involved in the serial killer culture. You know, you're not going to get something like a, 2020 or a History Channel thing with, you know, cuts every 2 seconds and, you know, crazy edits. It's not about that. It's as if you're sitting down with people involved in the serial killer culture. There are mentions of serial killers on the show, but it's really more about the culture involved around serial killers and the people that are involved in this culture, whether they're authors, whether it's a museum. It could be a murderabilia collector. It's such a broad topic that I thought, okay, this would be really cool, because when I was making a film on serial killer culture, I had known a lot of people involved, you know, musicians like Merle Allen and the Murder Junkies and Macabre, you know, bands that do songs on serial killers. So I was like, wow, you know, there's books, there's music, there's paintings. You know, there's so much that I could do on a show, and I think people would find this interesting, as well as, you know, authors such as yourself that write and deal with criminals and murderers and rapists and serial killers. People want to know what you go through. You know, what is it like writing to them? Do they, you know, Amanda Howard, who's an author from Australia, she was on the show from this season. She said it was interesting that one of these cannibals sent her a recipe, and she was the ingredient. it was for jambalaya. She's reading it. She's okay, you know, but then she comes to the end, and it's Amanda Howard. People don't experience these things on a daily basis like I might or you might or other authors or people involved, you know, that own this serial killers or whatever the case may be. And, you know, I thought it was, you know, a great opportunity for me to create a show that's contemporary rather than my other films, which, you know, like the historical horror trilogy, I call them, which, you know, were about biographies on these past serial killers. These are more contemporary. So this season, it's 6 episodes again, and the first one is Channeling Manson, and it is starring Michael Channels, who was a friend of Charles Manson's. He would talk to him on the phone, he would go visit him, he would collect artifacts from him, but he was an actual friend of Manson's for about 20 or 30 years, so he has a lot to say on the topic. And also in the episode, Channels shows us a lot of his collection and of course talks about his friendship with Manson, but he also takes us on a tour of the Spahn Ranch location where it was, and that was really interesting. I didn't know what I was in for. Yeah. I'm glad I did wear shoes, because here I was going downhill, uphill, you know, through all these weird paths, and it was definitely very interesting.
Yeah.
And then the second episode is My Friend Gacy, which stars Barry Vischelli, who wrote a book about being John Wayne Gacy's childhood friend. He grew up with John Wayne Gacy here on the northwest side of Chicago. And just a fascinating man. And, you know, he's on camera crying about how he has PTSD, how, you know, he really loved his friend when they were friends, but how, you know, he had to realize the fact that, you know, he killed these 33 young men, and, you know, he had, you know, these huge issues. He had to go in therapy, and he still has nightmares about it. So, again, I think the show is important because it shows us how many other people, you know, serial killers can affect, other than just the murderer, the victim, and the families of those two parties. There are so many other people that you know, these stories in fact.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many layers to that, you know.
Yeah.
We were just talking about the Golden State Killer and had an interview and stuff like that. And just think of the fallout that's going to have for him now that they've caught him and all of his family.
Yeah. You know, his family, too. They're going to have to go through. And, I mean, we've seen it over and over again with people like me and Dennis Rader and many of these people. And, you know, they're either distraught or, you know, they're in denial. You know, and that happens a lot, too.
Well, like BTK, he was just the average family man. His family never suspected.
Nope, yeah. And imagine that bomb dropping on you, where, you know, here's your father or your husband or your wife. Or, I mean, it's, you could see how traumatic it would be. And then the next episode, the third one, is Bunked by a Monster, which I believe, you know author Peter Bronski, and you worked with him before, maybe.
Oh, yeah. He published two of my books.
Yeah. You know, so he talks about how he bumped into Richard Cottingham in the hotel in New York and talks about other serial killers. He also met Chikatilo at one point before Chikatilo was apprehended. So he tells us some of these stories and, you know, his researches. He's interesting.
We had him on and he was just talking about the four F's of serial killer, and you have to keep beeping out the one because, you know.
Yes, exactly. I love that. I love it. When I first met him in Canada to film him, to interview him, he was living in this old building, which is now demolished. They demolished this whole area, but, you know, he had that office for a long time, and he showed me, like, this is like H.H. Holmes's castle. He would go in his door, come out another one, go downstairs, come out the back. He's like, it was like a maze, you know. He's running around. I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's had
fascinating. You know, and you know, again, these show segments are around, you know, 20, 25 minutes. But, you know, maybe in the future I might look at expanding them. People don't get too bored with them. But, you know, people do want more. You know, some of my worries are that, you know, that they're, you know, going to get bored of sitting and watching one person, but I think the subject matter is fascinating. Like I said, it's almost as if you're sitting with this person and they're getting to tell you their stories without being edited by, you know, for a soundbite.
Yeah.
And then another episode is Infamous Bathory, where author Kim Craft talks about her book called Infamous Lady, which is all about the myths and legends of Elizabeth Bathory. Did she bathe in blood? Was she a vampire? No. You know, and her book is phenomenal. I don't know if you checked it out, but you know, it's really amazing. You know, she found, you know, many of the writings of Bathory and these original texts that she had to, you know, translate. And you know, again, just another one of these, you know, historical stories that, you know, people, you know, believe in these organizations.
Yeah.
And,
another
one. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what was the most shocking one that a person you've met in true crime that you've been lucky enough to interview, I guess I would say?
Well, see, that's the thing. Shocking, that's difficult to think because I haven't met a serial killer. I haven't, you know, I've had, you know, some strange experiences. You know, I was involved in the BTK case a little bit, they subpoenaed my records, but, you know, nothing like that. You know, I mean, a lot of these people are kind of like, you know, almost like rock stars, like Joe Coleman or Merle Allen, you know, very interesting people where, you know, both of them, their homes and their apartments were very, pretty much everything serial killer or oddities. Well, Merle Allen's home were all serial killers. Like, I think he sold some of his stuff by now, but when I filmed them for the first season, I mean, every inch of wall space was covered with some kind of serial killer artifact, postcard, memento. Even his kitchen counter was covered with all the serial killer trading cards. You know, he would have wall space you know, that were just big enough for postcards of all serial killer postcards. Literally every inch of wall space you looked around was serial killer related material or his band, you know, the Murder Junkies. And Joe Coleman's little auditorium was kind of the same way, you know, just covered with, you know, writings from serial killers or paintings from them or strange artifacts and oddities. You know, when I filmed it for Albert Fish, he said, see that over there? And I, you know, it looked like a little mole in a cross. He's like, that's a piece of Jesus. That's Jesus' flesh in there. And I said, oh, really? He's like, I'm like, well, how do you know that? He's like, well, it depends on if you believe it. So, you know, it goes with the whole dime museum thing and the whole gap. And, yeah. You know, that's what I mean. You know, I could have been, you know, sitting in a cubicle for, you know, my life, you know, working in an office. But in a way, I'm very lucky that I've met such interesting people, you know, that, you know, whether they're authors or filmmakers or collectors and, you know, just fascinating, you know, people. And I'd like to do a whole season of this show where it's maybe like all female, you know, female people involved, you know, in the culture. You know, there's a Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast, you know, of course we have Catherine Brown, who's another author. You know, there's all these strange things. There's so much to cover, but, you know, if I had a budget, it would be amazing. You know, I can be more than you can do it quicker.
Yeah. Well, so, what do you attribute the fascination to? I mean, this goes beyond fascination. It's almost obsession, yeah. But what do you attribute that to?
Mine or other people's?
Oh, well.
mine, it was always the love of horror films and just the macabre and strange things. I mean, my whole life isn't like that. I don't live that way. I mean, you'd look at me and you'd never know. You know, I hardly wear black. It's not about that, but I've always been interested in the strange and unusual, you know. But, you know, other people, I think it's the same way, too. They probably got started out with horror films, and, you know, it just compounded into this real-life, you know, factor of, you know, this is real. It's like reality horror, in a sense, that these are real people doing these things, you know. And I always say that, you know, I kind of, you know, wish I wouldn't have called H.H. Holmes a monster because, you know, after making films and studying psychology of serial killers and abnormal psychology, that, you know, these people are still human once they're apprehended. You know, they don't turn into monsters. You know, they're still people. And I figure it's our job to, you know, try and find out why they're doing these things or what caused them, you know, and we still don't know. But I think that's what it is, you know. And in the old days, it must have been different. You know, like imagine when Joe Coleman or Rick Staton or Murrah Allen, when they were writing these killers, those were different times. You know, now you could go on the internet and see a letter by these killers. You could see their dead body or their victim. It's all, everything's on the internet. But, you know, try to imagine whatever 30 years ago before the internet, you know, it was even more shocking because, like, that's when, you know, I was starting to get into this stuff. And, you know, now I'm sure, you know, maybe people aren't fazed by it. I don't know.
Yeah, people get more accustomed to the gore and the violence, and they probably have a time separating reality from fiction too, as well.
yeah, exactly. You know, and it's, you know, and it's endless. You know, there are just so many cases, and there's so many facets to it as well. You know, not just there's the forensic aspect, psychological aspect, the detective work, you know, and that's why, you know, I'm fascinated by the earlier cases because of the efficacy of these, you know, tools and techniques that were being used and limitations, you know, and then some of them, it was almost impossible that they actually apprehended these people, you know, and you know, I'm fascinated by that. You know, I still want to complete my film on Jesse Pomeroy that I'm producing. And, you know, it was the same thing. It was 1874, and they had to telegraph another police station in the next district to see if this, you know, boy was released from one school. And, you know, again, just the strange tools and techniques they had at that time and how, you know, some of these serial killers slipped through their hands for so long because of the lack of those crime detection techniques.
Well, and that was when they used to wash down the crime scene.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Now all they need is 23andMe. So.
What do you think? Do you think that they're going to catch a lot of people that from the old times now that committed serial crimes like Zodiac with things like the DNA?
You know, they might. I mean, you know, the Golden State Killer is a perfect example. Who would have ever thought that they would have, you know, and I still don't know all the exact details. Wasn't it through a DNA from Ancestry.com or like he was looking into the Ancestry?
Yeah, it was 23andMe.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And he found out that he's 15% Scottish and 75% serial killer. But
yeah,
that was it. That's the telling.
Yeah. Then they went through both of them and basically found his mitochondrial, you know, the mother's DNA, and then they staked out some of his family, and one thing led to another, and there you go. You know, well, it's getting.
It could be possible. I mean, who knows? I mean, I don't know if, you know, I always believe it's luck and skill for everything. You know, they have to be skilled, but they're kind of lucky too to come across these things or hunt them down or find them or. You know, it's just like me when I do my research for my film, and as time goes by, it's harder for me to find information on cases that are from so long ago, you know, because the information gets lost or destroyed or accidentally disappears or people steal it or whatever the case is. And, you know, who knows? That stuff like that is very fascinating, you know, and I don't know. It would be interesting, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
That's why I've never personally been interested in the unsolved cases, because I'm more interested in the cases where somebody is apprehended, where we can study them, or maybe if they're going to tell the truth, hear their point of view for the reasons why they did these things.
Yeah.
But, you know, now we might find out who the Axeman of New Orleans is, and like you said, Zodiac and some of these other.
That would be cool to get Jack the Ripper once and for all.
Oh, that would be great. That would be great, you know.
I don't know, man. There's going to be so many disappointed people.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
like I said, I just wish I would have, you know, said he was H.H. Holmes before other people did. So I would have had a ton of publicity.
Well, don't you have a relative you can blame for all of it?
Right, I know. I got to look into my history.
Yeah.
There might be somebody somewhere.
There might be somebody. We just did the Ed Edwards again, and that was just crazy. He's done Joan Benet Ramsey now and Lacey Peterson. And
right.
It gets crazy. It gets just beyond reality.
It's interesting, you know, and again, you know, you have all these, you know, cases too that, you know, are made into these documentary series, whether it's not a serial killer like that. I was fascinated by that show, The Staircase, you know, that whole movie series. And, you know, just these other cases, like where these strange things happen, we may never know the murder or accidents or whatever it was actually occurred, you know. Like there was that owl theory, you know, and I thought that was fascinating because I couldn't, in my mind, of course, I don't have a PhD in these things, but I've studied them probably like you guys have, but I couldn't figure in that staircase how she could have had those damages. And then when that owl theory came forward, I'm like, well, that makes more sense than anything. Yeah.
It's crazy. You know, crazy things can happen and we just don't expect them, you know.
Right, exactly. You know, and now, of course, you have a lot of these armchair forensics people that think, oh, yeah, you know, it was the husband. He beat her over the head. It's a gun deal. But it's like, okay, but you're not, you know, I'm not an expert. You're not an expert. So how can you even do that? How can you say that when the experts, you know, aren't even able to prove that?
It was H.H. Holmes.
Of course. That's the easy thing to do. I should say that. That'll get us some publicity.
Yeah, you should. Just blame it on and say it was like a distant relative. It was my
great great grandfather's cousin.
Yeah,
I could get my whole mini series.
Yeah, that's right. It was. You know, like I said, that John Cameron's got that one on Paramount now, and every show is about who he killed, and it's everybody.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is, I was in, not that I have a lot of hair, but I was just in at a hair shop here the other day, and all the girls are running over because they know I do the show, and they're like, so what do you think of that? Ed Edwards killed all those people, and he was Zodiac too, hey? And it's like, well, no, I don't know that. It's just, there's no evidence.
Right. Exactly. And I get that too. And, you know, I want to sit down with these people and say, or I do tell them, I say, you know, do you have about 24 to 48 hours where we can discuss this? We probably don't have that much time right now. Because, you know, you can't. You can't sum it up in a sentence. You know, yes or no, you can't.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, it's just kind of like, oh, I heard he killed Lacey Peterson. Can you believe that? And it's like, well, no, I don't.
Yeah,
shot and then shot JR.
Yeah, it's just about that bad,
right? Yeah, that's the other bad thing about the internet too. You know, I don't know if I had mentioned it to you before, but you know, this was years ago that you know someone had put out there that oh yeah, you know Albert Fish, he was electrocuted by those needles in the electric chair, and he shorted out the electric chair by those needles inside him, and you know, I mean, I told them, I showed them proof of the book where his executioner wrote nothing unusual happened. Here's the guy that pulled the switch who was standing probably 10, 20 feet away from him. But they still like to believe the urban myth that, nah, you're wrong. I don't believe you. Okay. Well, you believe what you want, then I can't argue with
it. They don't want to, you know, then, and if the witness like that is strong, then they have to cut him down. You know, then they'll say, well, you know, he beat his wife, or he... We can't trust him, you know. It's crazy. You can't win. And it's all about feelings. I feel
that they
don't like someone, so they feel he must have been guilty.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Guest has been indie filmmaker. I'll just say filmmaker, John Borowski. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.